When we run the little sawmill, we only had about three grades. We had a clear, and which was absolutely no knots, straight grain, everything nice. And then we had number one, which all the usable lumber, and then cull, the stuff that wasn't any good at all. Then from the grader, it went on out to out the chain to the appropriate pile where the pullers, fellows who would pull the stuff off onto some blocks like, and then they'd have this, some mills had a forklift, but some mills had both, forklift and this straddle buggy. They could run over a pile of lumber with it and pick it up and take it out in the yard or take it wherever they wanted. When I was a kid, I run one of those straddle buggies, lumber carriers, for about 3 months. Now, that was too tame a job for me. Matter of fact, to get a little exercise, I used to run to work and run home. These straddle buggies were quite a piece of equipment. They were built up high enough, of course, to go over this pile of lumber, and they had these shoes that underneath, like, that you could wiggle back and forth and go under the pile of lumber and lift the pile of lumber and take it away. Of course, it was gas operated, just like a car or truck. One interesting thing was it would go just as fast forward as it did back. And as a young driver, I never backed up much. Boy, I sure had to learn how to drive backing up. After about a couple of weeks, so I got to be pretty good. However, I wasn't going very fast. Matter of fact, I got the name around the sawmill of being Lightning. I was so slow, they called me Lightning. One interesting thing about the lumber carriers, you left about 8 or 10 feet between your piles of lumber, and you could have a whole string of piles of lumber, and you decided you wanted the third one or the fifth one or whichever one. You opened up the shoes and you went right over the other piles till you got down to the one you wanted. You'd pick it up, and this lumber carriers, all four wheels steered, and you could pick it up and get out of that line of pile and take it to wherever you wanted it, to the planer or wherever it wanted to be. One little item I kind of wanted to get on the end of this tape was the fact that I spoke about a dry kill, where you put the lumber in and the steam heated the lumber up and dried it out or seasoned it, ready to, generally they would run through the planer and so forth, so it would season it. One interesting thing was that on these turbines, these big steam turbines that run the big generators, they would hook the steam line up to the dry kill, and the steam would actually heat the lumber, but it would also draw a vacuum. In other words, the vacuum, say you had 100 pounds of steam and 5 pounds of vacuum. Now the steam engineers really jumped on this vacuum system. The idea is that water expands around 1600 times when it's turned into steam. Well, it takes quite a lot of heat to make it do that. Well, on all the little steam engines we had, we just let it exhaust into the air. Of course, now the air is about 15 pounds per square inch. That's what we live on. So If we can get this vacuum, why, it adds to the, especially on the steam turbines, why, it added that much. Say you had 100 pounds of steam, 50 pounds of vacuum, then you had 105 pounds of pressure. And that made, might say, umpty nine kilowatts more on the machine. So they were really interested in cooling this outlet steam, exhaust steam, down as fast as they could so that it would make this vacuum. Now, they used all kinds of means of doing that. Sometimes they would run to their dry kill, and sometimes heating their offices, or sometimes some towns would have, the company towns would have hot water heat. And then in some of the colder climates, they even used a soil heating so that they could grow things in the, and then these greenhouses, mainly when they didn't use it for something like that constructive, why, they built this, what they called a water tower. It was, maybe 20 feet high or so, and had a lot of these steam pipes in it, and a lot of baffles, and they pumped cold water over these steam pipes to make them cool off quicker and make the vacuum. You've seen those in almost all of the mills. Lots of times they would also have a steam tower as well as doing other heating, because the other heating didn't make the vacuum enough to make it really good. I let other people review these tapes as I make them and so forth. And one fellow came up with, see, I'm so close to my subject that I don't really explain it lots of times. On this green chain where this man did the grading, he made a mark on this lumber. They had a regular code, and so that the person doing the pulling would know which pile to put it on. He wasn't grading himself at all. He watched these marks. If there was a number one mark and the thing was 10 feet long, he put it on the pile with the number ones and 10 feet. And if they happened to be longer, he'd put it in a different pile, whichever the mark called for. I kind of got ahead of myself there, really, on that one. Oh, I said before that these sawmills did their job, you might say, making lumber as efficiently and as fast as they could for sale. If an item didn't sell, why, they didn't make that type of board. So lots of times in some of the mills, say now like tuba fours, tuba sixes and so forth, of a certain grade, they'd pile all of the lengths up together. And then that pile of lumber would be sent through the dry kill and come out to the planer. Well, now, in all of these new electric mills, the planer was fast. It took about three guys to get the lumber away from it when they were shooting them right into a boxcar. It kept three guys in there real busy keeping them out of the way. Of course, lots of times these random length piles run it through the planer, and they come to what we call a dry chain. Same type of steel as the green chain, but it was just out of the planer. And they would probably, if they come out random lengths, well, there'd be three or four pullers there, and they would pull the sizes off so that they had them had the lengths segregated, so they're for saleable. So that is a dry chain. I was lucky, I guess. I never did work on the green chain. That was kind of a man killer. That lumber kept coming and coming and coming. You had to take care of it. Otherwise it run off the end, and then when you didn't have anything else to do, you had to go out and take care of it. I worked around about, 5 or 6 sawmills as an electrician. One shingle mill. A couple of them had their own little power plants, mainly for lighting, just one little generator, maybe a 10 kW or something like that. A shingle mill up almost to Vernonia up there, where it had this little 10-horse hooked up to a steam engine, and it was made just for lights to use there to so the packers could work a little later into the winter time. So anyway, the foreman on these jobs used to really like to have me show up as an electrician to do whatever service work needed to be done, because they knew I knew what it was all about. They could say, hey, Carl, the rolls on the Edrig don't work. They stopped. Well, I knew exactly where to go and what to look for. He didn't have to explain it any further. This tape was supposed to be one kid's sawmill, so I'll have to get a little story in here concerning me. Of course, I didn't know about it, but I was told about it probably 1,000 times later. There at the Holton Mill, that was in 14, 15, 16, along in there. I was 4, 5, 6. And I had a number of kids' little books. And every time somebody would come, if I possibly could, I'd get them to have them read to me out of the various books. And this one time, I think it was grandmother. I asked her to read to me or something like that, and she said, well, you read to me. So I picked a book up, and I proceeded to read, and she looked over, and I was on the wrong page. I had memorized all this stuff, and I was reading off of the wrong page. When we moved over to Oiklaw, I think it was early spring, we lived in tents. And I've heard Mom say that it rained every day that spring. I didn't notice it. I had rain clothes and so forth. We lived right beside of this little a brook stream, you might say. I think probably at high water it was different, but most of the time it was only about 10 or 12 feet across, about a foot deep in the most deepest place. This it come down over maybe 6 or 8 inches of big rocks, and made this nice little pool. My bed was fairly close there, about 20 feet from it, I guess. And as the water gurgled down over these rocks, why, boy, it really made good sleeping. So that was kind of nice. I spoke before about smelt running in the Cowlitz River, and I had this dip net and got it so full that it started pulling me down the river, and this fella grabbed it and helped me get it to shore. But there's another fish story here, that there at the Olequah Bridge, there was a kind of a flat place there in the creek. I don't think it was too deep, right? It was quite wide. Oh, probably 60 or 70 feet wide at that point. And quite flat. There was a deeper hole both beyond it and downstream too, but quite flat through there, and I think the road originally came through there, and you could ford it before they actually built the bridge. Well, I don't know why they did it, but there was thousands of these, what the Indians called chubs. I think it's C-H-U-B-S, chubs. They were a sort of a sucker, a round type mouth. And anything from 6 to 10 feet long, 10 inches, quite a slim type fish. And they would, what I call swarmed, like a bee swarms, but it would be flat. And they would actually turn themselves, it went kind of in a circle, this whole bunch of fish, and the ones on the edge would actually get shoved clear out on the rocks. So I spoke about my 10-pound lard pail, my about a gallon. I apparently had that with me, and I got, four or five, six maybe, of these fish, and I took them up and put them in this pool here, right by my bed, you might say. And they just stayed there. They were happy just to be there. I could look over there all spring and summer, and here they were, just they'd swim right toward the incoming water, and probably that was just enough food for them there. They would just swim there, just happy. They didn't seem to bother. And in the summertime, lots of times I would take my shoes off and put in there, within about 3 feet of them. They didn't even bother. Didn't bother to move. They just sat there swimming away. And incidentally, this little creek, its headwaters was in the little meadow that some of us boys started to build that log cabin in earlier tapes. The cougar showed up, cougar tracks, and you might say that stopped our cabin in the tracks. In thinking back, why those few fish that I rescued, you might say, why they didn't get turned into fertilizer. The story is that the Indians would, when they planted their, especially corn, they would take one of these chubs and put it in the bottom of the hole and made their corn grow good. Now, I never seen them do that, but I heard said that they did. Also, they say that the Indians, when they got short of food, they would eat these chubs. They were real good eating, except that they seemed to be so awful bony. I neglected to say earlier where we had our tents was an old, I imagine a homesteader's had a house there, or a cabin, had a well. We cleaned the well out and used it. I'm sure we had a cook shack there at the time, too. Or tent, whatever. We cleaned the well out so we could use it. And there was a real nice privy. I think it was a two-holer. And real nice shake roof on it and everything. I can remember that anyway. Apparently the house had, our cabin had burned, or somebody burned it up. I don't remember seeing any remains of the cabin at all. I just don't remember. As a little kid, I wasn't interested in where the cabin was or anything about the cabin. So anyway, I don't remember ever seeing any part of any cabin. See, I spoke earlier about various ones would homestead certain sections of timber. And this could have been one of those timber homesteads. Probably some of that timber that we cut or used at that time was one of these timber homesteads. I've spoke before about in school doing a lot of reading and so forth. I also took what they call the Boy's Life. It was a scouting type magazine. I think it's still going. At that time, there was quite a lot of trapping. People would hunt or trap certain animals for their skin. I found this, I'll say a family, a colony probably, of badgers. So I proceeded to set my little trap there. I caught me a badger, and I, in reading up on all of the trapper things in the Boy's Life, you skinned out the thing and you spread it out on some kind of a holder to hold it out nice and even and straight. And then you put salt on it, rub salt into the skin to preserve it and so forth. And I always wondered why the trappers always had their skins way up in the peak of the house, peak of their cabin, way up there, generally on the outside, way up high. Well, I found out real quick why they did that. See, with this salt on these skins and so forth, our tabby cat decided he'd like to have some salt. So he proceeded to chew some holes in my skin. Well, that spoiled it entirely then. So I forgot all about being a trapper. At the first of these tapes, I mentioned the fact that this was all the lessons that a young man learned around the sawmill. Well, this really wasn't connected with a sawmill, but it was a sawmill type, and there's a number of lessons in this. One thing is that very seldom do you ever get anything free. There's always some, if somebody gives you something, you feel like you have to give them something back. or do something for them on that order. The only thing I can think of that you might say is that you get that's really free, no strings attached, is if you find a quarter out in the street or somewhere. Of course, if you're in the house, well, you know it belongs to Mom or Dad. But if you find a coin of some kind out in the street, somebody's lost it, that's free. You haven't got any strings attached there of any kind. So that's free. Now, I'm bringing this up. One time, the Boy's Life, I believe it was, put up an ad to make as many words out of it as you could. I'm not sure that the words were Boy's Life, but they weren't all of the alphabet anyway. You made as many words as you could out of it, and then win a bicycle. Well, I truly took that to heart. Boy, I was going to have a bicycle. Of course, now, Mother said, well, if you get a bicycle here with this road like it is, you couldn't really ride it anyway. Said you'd have to take it out town or something where you could ride it, or down on the county road. So, but I proceeded to, I tell you, I took a school, not the great big school, unabridged dictionary, but I took one of those school dictionaries, and I proceeded to, I think it took me about a week to go through and pick out every word that I could make out of the words that I had. Like I say, it only covered about 10 different little different letters, so I didn't have to go clear through the thing. But I think I had 10 pages, great big tablet pages, on both sides. Boy, I was going to win that bicycle. And I, but Mom said, well, don't depend on it too much. But boy, I was really for it. All I really wanted was a subscription. I think they just tossed the rest of it. I don't think they ever even hardly looked at it or counted it or nothing. They just tossed it. Of course, I received the magazine for the year, like they said they were sending. So that pretty well cured me. I learned a lesson there real quick. $1 million, if, boy, that if is as big, and they make it as small as possible. Lots of times it isn't if. It said, maybe you will win, or maybe you will, we would like to see your name, we would like to give you, or whatever. All of those evasive type sentences and so forth. And they, I sure really learned a lesson on the ages like that. One time I was lucky, and in a small way, like, we were there at Warren in about 1918, and we went down to the county fair in St. Helens, and I went up to this wheel, and it had a lot of candy bars and gum and everything around on it, and you paid, I think, 5 cents, and you give it a whirl, and you got whatever the pointer come around to. Well, I went over there, and I paid my nickel, and I give it a whirl, and got a box of candy. That was the biggest prize on the whole board. Oh, boy. And I tried again. I got a box of candy. Two boxes of candy. Now, tried again. I got a box of candy. Two boxes of candy. Now, oh, man. I tried again. Three boxes of candy. Oh, boy. Then the operator put on a graham cracker covered with the chocolate on it. And I spun it again, and I got that. So I quit. I took the boxes of candy and went over and gave them to Mother. So that was real something for a kid. And speaking of the bicycle again, the roads were, well, I'll tell you, we came there in the spring of the year, early spring, and we set up these tents. There was a gravel road, I think it was, up to where the tents were from the station, oh, three or four blocks, something like that. So, but the road on up to the mill was just dirt. And, of course, with the teams and so forth, they didn't worry too much. The wagons would get down a little bit, but they could pull it all right. A time or two, Mother would try to drive the car up to the mill, and I have to laugh. Invariably, she got stuck. Well, of course, the teams were going back and forth all the time, and she was in the middle of the road, of course, so they'd have to unhook from their wagon and pull her out before they could get going. So she was lucky. She didn't have to sit there. At that time, you didn't call the AAA. There wasn't such a thing. This was at Olequaw, of course. And just as soon as they could get the mill going, why, the big thing of those old roads, you didn't have gravel and so forth to put on them. What little rocks and so forth you get at the creek wouldn't work out too good. And so they would use planer shavings. I spoke about it as a little kid in the second Warren Mill where they had all the planer shavings. And I was only about 6 or 7 years old and made it awful hard walking. So, planer shavings, and I can remember of Dad Sherman making the statement that they were using real good lumber to put crossways in the road in some of the bad holes. And that was real saleable stuff. He didn't want to use that. Of course, at that time, too, the Nebraska Bridge was hollering for planks. Well, this is the sixth tape of One Kid Sawmill, and I'm going to make this the last one. I like the idea of, hey, I started this last century. Now here it is, March of 2001. I have a little story here. I may not quite get it finished, but whatever. People who check these tapes, somebody come up and said, hey, the word Cayley, Dad Sherman's brother, Cayley, what, I never heard that name before. And it's quite obvious. Apparently, all three of the family were raised there in Maine and come out from there. Pearl, the older sister, and Harry, and Kaylee. Well, Kaylee is short for Caleb. And I think that probably was a old family name back in England somewhere. And they, of course, brought it out. Pearl, the sister, named her son Kaylee. And he was known as Little Kaylee. This is the end of the tape. Have a good day.